Hello and welcome to another episode of Is This Just Fantasy, for podcast where every other week, two nerds get together to rate, read and review a fantasy novel. I'm your host, Geordie Bailey.
And I'm his comrade in arms who, wait, no, have I been mentioned before? I don't know, Geordie, have you ever heard about me? I think I just died in the last chapter. You were really upset, but I don't think I've come up before.
Duncan, that's fantastic. Yes, we are cutting straight into a scathing but very fair critique of The Deed of Paxenarion, Book 1, The Sheep Farmer's Daughter by Rebecca Moon. I feel like that can't be right, right? For Rebecca Moon, yeah?
Yes. It's going to sound like Elizabeth now, and I do deeply apologise.
Elizabeth Moon. But I feel stupid. This is just like the time I accidentally called Hayley Piper, like, Holly Piper, right to her face before we interviewed her.
Honestly, that was embarrassing.
That was so embarrassing. Speaking of Pipers, Duncan, 10 minutes ago, the latest episode of Doctor Who ended, and apparently you have thoughts.
Yes. So as we record this, the final episode in the newest season of Doctor Who, the hit, amazing British sci-fi TV show, did air, and Geordie... Apparently, this has been all over the internet. It certainly hadn't come across my nose. Between sort of the Google homepage and the Conan subreddit, no one mentioned to me that we were getting a new Doctor. Character of the Doctor regenerates as a way to recast him, or her, as it was relevant. And yes, oh my gosh, I didn't know. I found out this live. So, Billy Piper, who appeared... earlier, many years ago, when I first started watching the show, played one of the companions, and she's now going to be starring in it. And I was completely blown away. I did not know this was happening. I'm very excited. I'm a little bit sad that Shutagawa is leaving already. I actually really enjoyed his time as the Doctor. And to be honest, I really felt like he needed a bit more time to breathe.
I have only seen one of his episodes. I saw The Well, and I thought it was really good. So I can't really contribute a lot to that. I actually have been on a bit of a Doctor Who kick, so I am somewhat prepared to talk about Doctor Who, but I've only gotten up to, like, Donna part of David Tennant in my big rewatch, so not so much.
That's pretty good going. That's pretty good. You're doing a big rewatch. I'm doing a let's go back and fill in the gaps from when I originally dropped off. I've been a big Doctor Who fan since it came back in 2005 with Christopher Eccleston playing the Doctor, and I watched it pretty consistently all the way through. When we talk about Doctor Who, we do it in terms of who's the leader actor is, so all the way up to the end of Matt Smith was sort of when I kind of petered out.
Petered out, nice one.
Thank you.
I remember when I was a little kid, because Duncan, I guess you and I started watching Doctor Who at the same time when it came back. Because my
most
first
episode, you would have been a little younger than me,
was
but
the Slovene.
The Slovene? Oh,
yeah,
they're
was,
the green guys.
It was legitimately
guys.
Too scary for me. Yeah, the flatulent green aliens. It was legitimately too scary for me, so I could only watch like a third of an episode. The monsters would show up, I'd get scared, I'd leave, and then my dad would tell me what happened the next day.
The idea that the Slovene are what scared you when we had the freaking gas mask children... in that season.
I did not make it very far into that episode. The moment that kid showed up, I was like, no. I think I might have even not watched it because I got too scared by the, like, introductory stuff from the previous episode.
For those who don't know what we're on about, Doctor Who is a scary show for a little kid. I really have a lot of respect for it, for kind of pushing to the edge and doing some genuinely tense episodes. To balance out some really lighthearted ones. I think what makes Doctor Who so great is the fact that it has a real variety act going, which makes sense for a character that can travel anywhere in time and space, provided it's within the BBC's budget.
Welsh quarries, yes.
So yeah, I loved it being scary. Can I just say, actually share another story about watching Doctor Who as a kid? It really takes me back, because when I was watching Doctor Who as a kid, this was the only show that really reminds me that I used to live in a world... where if you didn't watch the live broadcast, you were screwed.
Yep.
I remember going on holiday, and my mum had to ask our granddad to go and, like, tape a Doctor Who episode on VHS. Otherwise, we couldn't watch it.
It was such a big deal. it being such a big deal when we got a TV box, like not even like a VCR, like a box which you watch TV using, and it could record the episodes for you. Like, it would be slow as hell, and you could only record, like, I don't know, 20 episodes of any given thing. But that was how me and my parents watched so much television when I was, like, 12 years old.
Oh, it blew our minds. I remember when we got Sky, and I remember seeing for the first time the menu for selecting channels. Because up until that point, you just had a up and down button on the remote. Feeling old. But yes, Doctor Who, I love it. I've been rewatching it as well. And it's definitely a show that I think is consistently pretty darn good. I will have to critique the newer stuff. Not because it gets quite a bit of hate I've seen out there, which I don't agree with. If I have one real critique, is the fact that since Shutagawa became the Doctor, they shortened the season. Doctor Who used to run for like 12 to 14 episodes, if I'm remembering right.
Yeah, 13 episodes and a Christmas special.
We've been running on 8-episode seasons plus a Christmas special. And, oh, those 8 episodes, Geordie, aren't enough. Like, just for kind of reference, in Doctor Who, there's some kind of format points you quite often see. And the first episode is often introducing a new companion, like someone who's going to go on the adventures with the Doctor. Then the final is always a double bill. It's always 2 episodes. Okay, and then there's normally a Doctor Light episode. An episode which doesn't focus on the Doctor, but maybe one of the people he's met on the way. Or it's a new episode, but we're going to focus it on a less immortal character.
Yeah.
They can be some of the
Blink,
best.
You got Turn Left, Father's Day.
From last season, we had Bubble Dot, which I absolutely loved. These are great episodes, but what it means is then all of a sudden you've only got 4 normal, I'm doing air quotes there, people, normal episodes a year of just the Doctor on an adventure. And it only takes 2 dud episodes, and you're only then watching 2 good, normal, regular adventure episodes a year. And that's just like, what? And that's really my feeling on the new Doctor Who. I feel like it's got the same number of duds that it ever had, but because there are just less episodes, there are then less highs to make up for it. In my opinion.
You could say the same about Star Trek as well. It's the same situation where you have these episodes. And a big emphasis now on like seasonal arcs. Like, aside from Bad Wolf, which is shit, by the way. I don't know why people like it. It's terrible. You don't have that many seasonal big things happening in the early parts of Doctor Who. But to my understanding, once Moffat gets his grubby little hands on the show, it becomes about having these big season-long arcs and these mysteries. And I'm not about that. It's just a waste of time. You got to have... Doctor Who is about a weird man and his friends go to a location, bad stuff is happening there, and then we have to just sort it out. And occasionally, they've blown the entire budget, and the entire episode has to be shot inside a hotel room.
It's happened more than once. And occasionally you're like, wow, I don't know, they didn't know they had the budget for this. But I think what I always really enjoy is that you go in each week and you're like, are we going to do some sort of dead space monster hunting people around a derelict mining operation on a distant asteroid? Or are we going to be in some Bridgerton-style ball doing some politicking and also being hunted by some alien monster? You don't know, and I think that's where the real charm is. It's the variety it throws. And I think with any show that relies on a lot of variety, there are duds, but there's often enough good to kind of carry it through.
Duncan, you know that Doctor Who does novels, right?
Doctor Who novels? I am aware, because I keep getting recommended. I say keep getting recommended. That's a lie. There's a big sign in my local library to, like, promote, what do you call it? Like, lesser-known books by well-known authors. They've got, a little display section on that theme at the moment. And there's one I keep catching my eye, which is that Douglas Adams apparently wrote a Doctor Who book. And I'm like, Oh, that sounds like it should be up my street.
Yeah, he was a Doctor Who writer. That was like, I think that was Tom Baker days. Anyway, the point being is that, Duncan, in the future, theoretically, we could do a Doctor Who novel because it is definitely not pure sci-fi. I watched Satan Pit, and that is just a Satan in someone's basement.
Oh, they're full on doing magical gods in the newer seasons. Like, those are like some of the big bad. There is a, he literally calls it, like, the pantheon of forgotten gods is one of the bad guys.
Oh my god. Anyway, the point being is that if we really wanted to, we could always do that in the future. And they do have writing competitions to submit stories, which can then be published. So we could actually pitch our own Doctor Who episode / short story for a competition if we really wanted to.
I mean, that would be incredible. Geordie, I think you would discover how woeful my creative abilities actually are. But that would be amazing. So, Geordie, this is clearly what I've been watching and doing with all my spare time. Before we get back to the actual focus of this episode, which, yes, is doing The Sheep Farmer's Daughter by Elizabeth Moon, if you have forgotten, and I don't blame you for that. Geordie, have you been experiencing anything else you'd like to share with us?
I have. I'm cognizant of the time, though. I'm going to have to chop down that Doctor Who section a bit anyway. I'll be really brief because I've read a ton. I've really been on a roll because the books I've been reading are very different from what I normally enjoy. They're very out there, but I've been reading a lot of chick lit.
Oh, have you now?
Yes, I have. So I read, let's have a look, see. I've got Always a Bridesmaid by Erin Clark and Laura Lovely. That's a very strange, okay, love story. It's about a woman who is a bridesmaid for hire, please hold your questions, and a man who doesn't like marriage falling in love. You may now ask questions.
Did you like it?
It was all right. It just was okay. It was written in kind of a pedestrian manner. I liked the follow-up Love Rebooted a lot more. It dragged a little bit in places, but it was actually engaging. It had a strong narrative voice between the two protagonists. Yeah, I like that one a fair bit more, even if the ending is a little bit rushed. And I also started reading Crazy Fake Love Song, which I'm enjoying a lot. That one's way more YA and very cute. But yeah, on a real reading kick, I got a lot done when we were supposed to be reading this book.
Well, I can't quite make the same claims. This book took some of my time to get through. So, Geordie, no more beating about the book. People listening, if you're a big fan of this book, that's great. Why don't you tell us why you love it so much at thisisjustfantasypodcast@gmail.com or on Instagram at thisisjustfantasypodcast? Because, oh my dear God, I feel like I'm going to have to hear some people telling me what the positives are. Because this book, you know, it's not up there, but it's got a good rep.
Yeah, it's and got Geordie, like 13,000 reviews.
Yeah, this is not an obscure, disliked piece of work. And I think I'm going to have to work quite hard to articulate things in, this is what it does, this isn't to my taste. But Geordie, I did not like this book, if that wasn't obvious.
Wow, it's come right out with the dislike word. I think this book is like, okay. I don't dislike it. I don't love it at all. I think it's like, this is completely possible. I don't exactly regret having read this book. I might regret the amount of time it took to read this book, because it's much longer than it needs to be, especially considering this isn't even like a complete book. The Deed of Paxenarian is the book, and this is just part one that's like had to be published separately. It's like volume one of one book.
And I think that's very important to note. And I think maybe this is like with Magician that we talked about earlier in the year, where you said if you just read Magician's Apprentice, you would be like, well, this is bloated, this isn't going anywhere. But having the whole story makes it work.
Maybe.
Maybe that could be the case.
One hell of a book, though. This is not a short novel.
No, it's not. And that's why I had this conversation with my partner, literally kind of just before coming on. And she said, well, you know, I was getting near the end. You know, what if it's really great in the last, like, 10 or 20 pages? And I went, well, then I'd be more annoyed. Because then it would mean that Elizabeth Moon could have been writing of that level of quality the whole time and was somehow, for some reason, choosing not to. A book this long, and which is a standalone product that you can buy, should be good enough on its own. And I did not find it. And Geordie, I think this is what I'm trying to articulate, is that this is not a terrible book. But I found this a bit of a dull drag.
Apparently the full book is about 300,000 words. Which is like modestly long for a fantasy novel. It's like a Game of Thrones book.
I would not be pushing my way through that. So Geordie, let's talk about what this book's about, and then maybe I can unpack how I felt, and maybe you can bring me round. Because, again, you I think you're like, what, to put it in numbers, and I know we don't like to do this, a 6 out of 10 vibe? Have I got that right?
I was thinking of out of 5, so I'm going to say a 6.8.
Okay, in that case, I'm sitting at like a 4.8. I personally, if I could get the time back, would have not wanted to have read this book.
I feel bad now.
purely for the fact that it was just, for me, I struggled to engage on a very character level. And so let's talk about the key characters at play. The Deeds of Pax Anarion follows our main character, Pax. She is the sheep's farmer's daughter, who one day is like, "No, Dad, I don't want to marry that man. I don't care that you've paid a dowry. I want to be a fighter. I've listened to the stories of my cousin and the adventures in the world. I'm running off to seek adventure." Great concept and start.
Yep.
Pax joins a mercenary band. She pledges loyalty to the Duke and will fight in his army. And it kind of goes from there. We get a lot of her training in the first kind of third of the novel, and then we follow her through sort of two campaigns of war.
Mm.
And as the story goes on, there's some key, almost could have been tales on their own sections. It ultimately comes down to, there is a bad mercenary leader called the Honeycat, and the latter half of this novel is all about kind of chasing this man down.
Yes, exactly.
But the focus really is on Pax and her life as a mercenary, as a fighter.
Exactly.
And what that is. I did do a bit of background. Elizabeth Moon did serve. She was in the Marines. I believe, if I got this right, she was even in Vietnam for a time. So she has a military background, which I can clearly tell she's pulling on and wants to kind of give us this sort of less high stakes adventurous feel of war and more of the mundanity of being a soldier.
That makes so much sense. I cannot express how unsurprised I am by that. The only thing I find like surprising at all is how unjaded the book is in that way, because Pax is such a shining little beacon of joy a lot of the time. She's very endearing and like believes in the good of what she does and who she serves with. I'm merely surprised that, you know, it's so rosy about these sorts of things, even when there's like bloodshed and war happening. And it's also unsurprising to me to learn that Moon served, because the book that this reminds me of in a very topsy-turvy way, the most that we've done, is The Black Company.
I'm so glad you've drawn that line, because I was making many a comparison to The Black Company while reading this book. And I'm glad you said a topsy-turvy way, because it is confusing, because in terms of writing style, Elizabeth Moon and Glenn Cook have very different approaches, mm-hmm. even if they're trying to scratch at the same ideas about telling an epic fantasy.
Yeah, imagine they'd been given the same writing prompt in like a writing class or something, and they've gone at the same prompt in a very different way. You're telling the story of a mercenary company going up against an evil sorcerer. Go.
I'll be honest with you, Geordie, I tried very hard not to keep thinking about Black Company, because I have to admit, that is a book that I infinitely prefer.
I mean, it's a better book. There's just like, it's not really a fair comparison almost. It's just, they're in different weight classes. Deeds of Pax Anarion is like a straightforward adventure story, and the Black Company is sort of a complete reimagining of what a fantasy novel is even supposed to be.
So Geordie, I feel like I've gone at it a bit. Do you want to kind of mount your defence on this?
Sure. I mean, I feel like we're already tiptoeing around what it is I like about the book, which is that I like how authentic it feels. You know, like they say that war is 99% boredom, 1% terror. And that's what this book is. This is a book about the long stretches of nothing happening as soldiers go on the march between locations. And then when battles do happen, and I genuinely do like this, even though it's almost problematic, I like the fact that fights start so unexpectedly fast, they take up a very small amount of page time, and then, like, Parks walks away with a critical injury that leaves her incapacitated for a while. On one end, I don't like that so many of these scenes are quite same-ish, but it does actually, it strikes a chord in me, and like, yeah, this feels like I'm reading a war biography. This feels like I'm reading about soldiers in World War II, or soldiers in Afghanistan. And it's like, suddenly there was fighting, and then suddenly it was over, and then we just had to deal with it and pick up the pieces afterwards.
Well, I think it's very fair to say that Elizabeth Moon, you know, is it that I'm just not picking up what she's putting down? Because I kind of like that. I do like the idea that you're sort of in the mundanity, the characters are bored. You know, oh, it's 99% boredom. I just would like to put it out there that you can write a story where the characters are bored. Doesn't mean that I should be flicking through the chapters going, oh my goodness, when are we going to get to the next thing? Enjoy the fact that when fights break out, Pax, I love the as you said, sometimes she gets a critical injury and she's out of the fight. And it can almost feel like anticlimactic. Like we're not getting the traditional beats of combat, of going back and forth and heroic fight scenes. It's sort of interesting, talking about like a grounded fantasy, throwing back to something like Best Served Cold, which is a bit more of a, you know, a low fantasy setting, but our heroes are still like action heroes, still over the top. Pack is not an action hero. She takes wounds and that's it. Well, sometimes we don't even see the end of the fight. Sometimes she just gets knocked out and it's like, it feels like mid paragraph. Yeah, and we pick it up and she's in the surgeon tent.
Yeah, I really didn't like how often that happens, because it's a trope I dislike, but it happens so rarely in books that I really don't have a lot of time to complain about it. But there is such a tropey thing that happens when someone just gets hit in the head, and then we move on to the next scene when they wake up. You see this all the time when characters like captured, and it's like, they put a bag over my head, and that's the end of a chapter. And it just allows authors to very quickly move on from a scene and start the next one. And I really hate it. It's so lazy. And it's done so many times in this book. And it's egregious, to be honest.
I think that's particularly... Actually, I'm glad you've picked that up. Because that's, I think, what brings a lot of this to fault. It's not that what's being laid down that's a problem. It's the fact that I felt throughout this 440-page novel, it kept happening. They'll be on the march. It will be boring. They'll be posted as sentries. At some point, they'll be ambushed. Pax will go in there with her shield. We'll get a description of her holding her shield and wrestling back and forth. She'll kill someone, and then she'll get sliced, and then she'll fall back, and then her sergeant will yell, "Get her out of there." And I swear this feels like it plays out 5 to 6 times.
Yeah. And, you know, going in, as you say, the actual fighting itself, because it's so abrupt and chaotic and brief, it doesn't actually invest time in being exciting or cool to read about. There's only one scene in the whole book where it actually feels like a sword fight being described in a book, and it's when she intervenes to save that paladin. And I don't even think that's like a full page. It's like two exchanges of blows, and then she gets knocked unconscious again by magic. I have genuinely read more exciting action scenes in books which aren't even novels. You know, like, I read Stalingrad this year, and I feel like I got more exciting action scenes in that book about a historical battle. Or, like, scenes of which have been recounted in, like, Band of Brothers, where people are like, this happened, like, on D-Day plus one. And you're like, this is genuinely kind of exciting to think about, because it's being remembered by veterans who are going back over stuff they did 50 years ago.
There's very little sense, I find, in these fight scenes, and again, I really want to differentiate what is being intentionally put on the shelf and what is just not being done as well as it could have been done. And I feel like a lot of these action scenes, what we miss is any real sense of what's going on in Pack's head. I talked long time ago, I think when we were doing Green Rider, about I love it when we're in a combat and it's set up like a puzzle to our main character. They're thinking, they're engaging with it. You see what they're doing. They'll specifically use something they've learned, but then have to, something will go wrong, they have to improvise. Or they'll maybe even with Pax, if she's going to like stick to how she's being drilled, let's spend some time with her going, you know, saying to herself, like, do this, stay calm, focus on what I've learned, that will see me through. And this is where I think something that I think hits the action scenes and hits a lot of the other scenes, something that is quite often a hallmark of Geordie's complaints. Geordie, I really struggle with the point of view in this book.
Yes,
agreed. I don't know, it doesn't always happen. It's really weird, but this is a third person limited.
Well done, yes.
I got the technical term. I'm literally rubbing my forehead as I said that. I'm like, come on, Duncan, you can do this. You got it. Third person limited.
What does that mean, Duncan?
And that's fine. That means it's not the character describing, you don't have as much of their inner thoughts. But, you know, it's still Pax did this, Pax did that. But we're staying quiet. The camera's locked behind Pax. And that's true for 90% of the novel. There's a few chapters that is broken for, but they're quite explicitly broken out from the rest of the text. And this shouldn't be a problem, because that's how Game of Thrones is written. The camera jumps between characters, but it's still third person limited. You see what they're seeing.
Mm.
But with Pax, something's just not quite landed here. And I felt like there was just an awful lot of being told what was happening in the world, and not a lot of being told how Pax felt about it. I felt quite a disconnect.
Yes, I definitely agree. There are times when this happens and the book really suffers for it. And this is a problem of perspective, because you really want Pax to weigh in and have an opinion, and she just doesn't. She refuses to offer an opinion. You know, you have scenes of, like, atrocities happening, and you expect Pax, who's our hero, our main character, to be the one to stand up and say something, because she's going to be a paladin. You know, that's what the book is about. This is the prelude to her becoming one. She's going to be a valorous knight, defender of good. And she doesn't say anything. You know, she just stands behind her sergeant or her captain whilst they do something. And that probably makes a lot of sense. Like, you know, she's a low-ranking soldier. I'm sure, as with Moon to her, it's like, well, obviously, you know, the private's just going to wait and do as they're told. They're not going to stand up and make a stand. But it feels very out of nowhere when at the end, like, Pax is the person who gets to make the big decision about what happens to the bad guy, because she's never been asked to give an opinion up till now. And later, when people are talking about the decision which the Duke made, but was actually her decision, she's absolutely terrified that anyone will know that it was her decision, because she doesn't want people to judge her for actually having an opinion.
And I think, on the one hand, that is quite a strong, maybe thematic note. Pax, in this first book, she's not special. She's just, I'm a rank and file soldier. That's all I want to be. I don't want to stick my head up against the parapet. She doesn't want to be the hero. And that can work.
Which is great until the halfway point. You set up Pax, you have her join a company, you have her go through basic training. We see her go through basic training in a lot of detail, which I'm sure a lot of people won't like, but I actually did like. I just liked that whole section, basically. And then at the halfway point, Pax needs to come into her own. This does happen. She gets removed from the military structure. She's told by, like, her superior officer, I'm wounded. Pax, you need to be the one who's making decisions now. And for the most part, Pax doesn't really make any really big decisions. it keeps being a sort of community activity making these decisions.
It seems like this weirdly staggered character growth. I feel like I'm being told this is the arc that Pax is going to go on. And then it's like it sets it up. All the pieces in play. Right, you're finally going to grow and learn. And then you just don't. It feels really weird. It feels sort of hollow and empty. Like I've kind of just stumbled into a pit. Mm. I'm like, where's my character growth? What's happening? And it's not even just in this character growth moment. I also found, even just sort of the mundanity, talking about like the mundanity of being on the march. There's a really great section, a pretty good section, where we're getting, they're marching and it makes it clear, oh, well, the people in the front get it easier because they're turning the road to mud. So the people at the back are having a harder time marching. Lovely little detail. Oh, chef's kiss. I get that. Well, nice thing to drop in there. But what
yes,
I just
I
wanted
like that a lot.
Is maybe a bit from Pax to really emphasise how this kind of load of fatigue is impacting her. She's our main character. So while we get this description of, you know, rotating people in the march order, we don't get Pax exhausted, like pulling her boot out of the thick mud one more time. We don't get her at the end of the march falling back into her bunk, being like, it's finally over, or being told, right, you're on sentry duty, and her having that moment of, oh, but I'm so tired from what I've come through. It just sort of glazes over into the next thing.
This year, Duncan, I can't remember if I brought this up already, but one of the books I've read this year is The Hooligans of Kandahar, which is a book. It's a semi-autobiographical book presented like a novel, but actually based upon the author's experience of serving in the United States Army in Afghanistan in the early 2000s. And this book is all about the same sort of thing that this book is. Obviously, it's not about Chosen Ones or Paladins or Dark Sorcerers. That's his other series. I'm only half joking. He writes sci-fi. But there's a big emphasis in that book about just like the stupid bullshit soldiers get up to when they're bored. Like there's this chapter where they're given this stupid command to reinforce their barracks. Duncan, their barracks are an old, worn out like shower block, which they've just put their like, they put their rucksacks and their bedrolls in, and they spend this whole chapter reinforcing it with sandbags, and then they cover it in barbed wire, and then they put, like, not mortar rounds, what am I saying, claymores on it as a joke, which is extremely dangerous. And then their commanding officer comes in, has a good laugh, and says, this is great, this is the most secure barracks you've ever seen. Now take it all down. And that scene is funny, and it's stupid, and it makes you go like, hang on, these are the people who are supposed to be fighting the Taliban? Because it's so full of character, it's so vibrant, that even though it's about stupid bullshit, which doesn't matter, it's very engaging to read. Now, Duncan, part of the reason I brought up the Hooligans of Kandahar is something I just want to highlight, which is that in that book, Joseph Kasabian, the author, doesn't give, I think for the most part, he doesn't give any of his comrades' names. Now, part of the reason for that is he does literally describe war crimes. Not awful war crimes. Nothing capital W, capital C war crimes, but definitely war crimes. And he literally doesn't want to implicate his former comrades for legal reasons. But the other reason it works is when he gives characters names like Hick or like Smelly, like he's giving them simple personality traits, which makes it easy to remember who it is. Like there's Grandpa, like a character called Grandpa. He's like a grandpa because he's like 29 years old instead of 19, so he's ancient. And this allows you to latch on and say, okay, yes, this character has been nicely summed up. It makes me very easy to remember who he is. And when he shows up in subsequent scenes, I know how he's expected to behave, and therefore I have a sense of anticipation of, oh, how's Grandpa going to react when he walks in and sees this, you know?
This is in contrast to the background characters in The Sheep Farmer's Daughters. Is that what you're driving at?
That is what I'm driving at. When, at a certain point, very tragically, a character dies, and then, like, several chapters after his death, I went, oh, it was that guy! Oh, I didn't realise!
Right, I'm going to read this out because this was my opening joke. Because I say joke, this might have been gambit because this bugged me so much. I'm going to just read you straight from the book on this one. When the cohort was reunited before the march back up to Valdir and winter quarters, Pax learned that two more of her recruit unit had been killed. Coben, who had been a friend since her first day as a recruit, and Sol, a cheerful brown-haired girl. Who are these people? I have never heard of them before. I even flicked back. I was like, when? Who did you chat to? When was, who's this Sol? This is the first time you were mentioned. Coben, who'd been a friend since her first day as a recruit.
There were two girls when then she joined. Then why not on she the first day?
Have a scene in the bunks of them chatting and bonding. There's one scene at the start of this book where the recruits have like a non-training related conversation. And it's about their gods.
Yep.
It's about, oh, what religion do you have? And where you come from? Oh, I have this religion. And you're like, wow, that's amazing foreshadowing. Tell me more about your Lord Gerd.
Yeah, it would be way better if in that scene they could refer back to, like, stuff those characters had done. Like, if you, like, have one of those guys be a klutz and, like, have him mess up a spear drill. And then later down the line, you can have Pax, when she learns he died, like, think, like, did he die because he messed up again? Like, that old klutz? And the other one, like, is like, I remember when she fought by my side in that shield exercise. I wish I'd been beside her today as well.
It just would have been so nice that, and I'm not saying you can't name drop the fact that, you know, this is a wider unit. Maybe not everyone can be a character, and some people are going to die on the outskirts. But, Geordie, I'm going to be honest with you. Leaving, like, the training at the start of the book, I had confidence in, like, four other characters. Well, five, you include the Duke, who weren't Pax. I knew the Sergeant, Samel. I knew, I've even forgotten his name, but he's, like, Lieutenant. Or, no, one below Sergeant, whatever it is.
Corporal.
And Corporal, thank you. I knew the Corporal. And I knew the two people that later go on the mission midway through the book. Because one was that person from the religious conversation, and one was the other guy who got characterization.
You're one over me, Duncan. You really did. I think I had, like, three people, including Parks. Like I said, like, one of the people you just mentioned was like, oh yeah, the other guy who got to talk during the trial section of a book. More on that later. I didn't even realize that he was in that mission until after he was dead. It's like, and he got back the necklace, which I bought for him, and I'm like, oh, right, the necklace. But here's the thing, Duncan, I didn't even realize that the guy she bought the necklace for was the same guy who stood up for her during the trial. I thought he was from three different people.
I don't want to lay it on us, particularly when you have later scenes where, and then, said Natzelin, picking up the tale, we fairly took the place over. It was ugly. Who's Natzelin? When did this guy come around? Or Arnie? Arnie Startled?
I don't remember any of these people. Vic? You're just saying names, Duncan. What I think they aren't even in the book. You're just making
these
them up.
These are names I started to note down when I first felt like I read them. And it just drives a real comparison. And I'm now going to do that Black Company thing. In the Black Company, you have... This is where I fall apart again. But you have Croker, you have Elmo, you have the captain and the lieutenant, you have Croker and One Eye, you have Raven, you have Darling, you have a kind of a core cast of, like, these are the characters that matter. Yeah. Another example might be Berserk, with even characters that have not been, like, Pippin and Kaska. I have forgotten some of the other names. Oh, I feel bad. Caucus. There's sort of like a core cast of like eight characters who are the faces. And then you have sort of the background, you know, oh, my a fellow brother in the company kind of vibe. Whereas what I'm having some difficulty in this book, this sounds so stupid, because quite often all characters will just get assigned a name when they speak. I'm left as a reader going, wait, were you one of the earlier characters, or have you just been thrown a name?
I think it, yeah, and it's really hard to keep track of. And the point is, which we've sort of danced around, is that we would remember these guys if they had distinct personalities, if they stood out, if they had habits, if there was something about them that, like, even, like, annoying leitmotifs, like a guy who always picks his nose, you know, even something as simple as that, or a guy who is at one point, like, a character's thing is don't gamble with this guy because he cheats, and that guy should constantly be in the book, and people should be talking about don't trust this guy, or hey, we need to use this guy because he's tricky, you know, like, we should be putting a really big emphasis on building up distinct characteristics that we can come back to later.
A lot of people only seem to talk about the military stuff going on. There's very little actual downtime life chat in this book. These guys got their eye on the mission.
Right, but the problem is, Duncan, is that the missions themselves don't actually matter.
Well, no. No, they don't, in the sense that we, as a reader, and maybe this is, again, or is this what we're going for with Pax being like rank and file? I had no idea what the grander context of this world
Absolutely
was.
Absolutely none. I was so lost. I was like, when they started fighting the Honeycat, I'm like, okay, why are we fighting the Honeycat? I know why you don't like him, because he attacked you guys. But why did he attack you guys? Is he on the same side as the people you were fighting beforehand? And who were they exactly? Like, you were hired by someone else to fight these people. Why was the Honeycat involved? And the Honeycat was involved over here. Why did you have to travel so far to get to him if you're not in his turf? Legitimately, what is going on? And then they get into another fight subsequently. And I assume this is against Silvanari, the Honeycat. But it's not. It's just a fight against an unrelated city. And then after that, they actually go after Silvanari.
I've often said that it's been observed between the two of us, Geordie, I like a bit of world building.
It has been observed.
More so than you do. I will forgive quite a lot if I'm enriched in a world, in a magic system, in a culture. And there are nuggets of it. There are little moments when they're first going to their big city. And they're like, oh, around here they do it this way, or around here they wear a lot of the silks.
Right, and this is the livelihood of a mercenary company. Like, don't go into city with, like, just with all your money on you because you get robbed. And don't go in alone because you'll be sold into slavery. And you're like, whoa, this is a hardcore and dark world.
But I had no wider idea to the city-states that they were fighting. I had no idea how big the world is. Is there an ocean? There is a map at the front, but I didn't feel like I was being referred back to it all that often. I never really had a good idea, like, the Duke. Is he an actual Duke?
Well,
some people are saying no, some people say yes.
That's true.
Do they have land? Who's he? He's running a mercenary company. Is there a king? Is there an emperor? Is it like the Holy Roman Empire? I read this entire first book, and I have no idea
apparently
what the state of this world is.
Also, I was analysing the Wikipedia page to remind myself of some of who the characters are. There is a true king out there somewhere who Park is going to restore in a subsequent book, but I didn't even notice that we were missing a king.
Not in the slightest. And going back on to the idea of cultures, I am cherry-picking the few moments that I really felt kind of made a significant difference. We march across what feels like half the world. Well, from the north to the south, that's very much laid out.
Yes.
But I never got a sense of what's the... I'm going to do a comparison to my favourite, old favourite, Robert E. Howard. You read Conan. Yes, he uses very simple real-world cultures to imprint on his fantasy settings. But at least then I know what architecture to imagine. Mm-hmm. When they attack some of the later day cities, all I'm doing is sort of benign, late medieval looking townships. I don't know what the individual flair, I don't know where I am in the world. I assume I'm just in a kind of Europe, because I felt like I wasn't given anything more to conflict with that.
There was a point where they met up with another mercenary company. Actually, technically, they were like a militia, not a mercenary company. And they are from the south, and they have a distinct identity. Their identity, however, only came down to they were acting like an actual mercenary company instead of like the honorable one, which the Dukes and the Halverics represent. The only thing that was used otherwise to make them distinct was that they were wearing purple and green. And I paused, I said to myself, are these guys Scottish? Because that's a common tartan pattern. So from then on, I just imagined they were Scottish.
Ah, those southern Scottish people.
Those southern Scottish scoundrels. Always pillaging and stealing and being sexist.
That's the difference. I feel very... what do I have put it? I think it's very convenient for our main character that she runs away from home. And the very first mercenary company she bumps into just so happens to be the most holier-than-thou perfect people who will always do the right thing, have a noble duke, and very little conflict arises at all.
Now, to be fair, Parks does join this company because she's been told by her cousin that it is a good and honourable place. Now, I will say that when this is presented to me as a reader, I went, aha, and part of her journey is going to be learning that it's not all sunshine and roses, and that, you know, like, armed forces and the military can be a very grim, dark place, and oh no, wait, they really is just good and honourable and true.
Oh yes, they are. Now, this comes to a bit of a head quite early on, how honourable and noble the company is. Because very early on in this book, and I mean quite early, I think we're on like chapter 3 or 4, there is, and I'm going to have to do sort of a trigger warning for this next section, there is a sexual assault against our main character, Pax. Now, when this first came up in the book, I personally was like, it almost took me left field. I was like, oh, is this what we're driving at? This seems quite a important thing. And it's also one of the more interesting writing choices.
It is interesting.
Geordie, I actually quite enjoyed this section because... Yeah. I enjoyed the intro to this section because we cut from the end of the last chapter where Pax is sort of, I don't know, on the parade ground going about mundanity. And you turn to the next chapter and immediately it's like Pax is in a cold, dark cell. And you're like, okay, I am not being present.
Yeah, yeah.
What happened? What went down?
I agree. I think that this section, and to be honest, Duncan, the weird thing is, I have to say, yeah, I did enjoy this section of the book. I think this is probably the best section of the book, because this episode is suddenly, it stops being about a mercenary company, and now you're reading fantasy Law and Order Special Victims Unit. This is an episode about, like, a detective court case. Parks stops being our perspective character, and it becomes about her sergeant, and her sergeant is like, you know, Parks is being accused of, like, attacking a superior officer and has now been arrested, but something about this is fishy. I'm going to do an actual, like, detective work. Like, I'm going to do a proper investigation. I'm going to isolate people and ask what happened, look for clues, and it's going to end in an actual trial and tribunal where the truth is going to come out. And it's going to be, like, expert witnesses and, like, medical examinations. And this section is such an abrupt change from the rest that it becomes very exciting and dynamic and tense, because you're like, there's actually a good chance that the truth is not going to come out. And that Parks is just going to have to live with the fact that this has happened. Well, okay, let's see what's going to happen then.
So to kind of talk through this event, I told you earlier that third person limited, and this is one of the few chapters where we shift away from Parks to the sergeant, Stamil. By the way, when this first happened, I began to think, oh, are we going to, like, as the book go on, shift around the company? That could be an interesting...
It doesn't. That didn't happen. Anyway. Nope.
But the detail in this section, the, as you mentioned, the, right, has anyone talked to them yet? No? Right, I want them separated in that other room. No one communicates. Split up these people. Has he gone to bed yet, the officer on the watch? No? Right, I need to speak to him at once. I need a doctor down here immediately so that they can witness and give testimonies later. It's so detailed. There's a bit where they get one guy and they're like, right. And he's like, oh, I don't really remember what happened. And they're like, Well, did you drink anything funny? It's like, I had a glass of wine with the head butler. And they're like, okay, get the butler, check the cask, check his drink. It felt like proper investigation. They were going down all angles. I was like, this is weirdly good investigation writing about an investigation for this style not to come back. I think that's what really threw me, is this stylistically feels very different to the rest of the book.
Yeah, and maybe that's because we're in Stammel's head, and that like flavors it in a different way, that we are seeing it through his eyes. But I have something more to say about the way perspective is used in this book, but let's not focus on that, and let's not get bogged down over details on this, because what I think we should be talking about now is the fact that we're reading a book written in the 80s. It's a fantasy novel by a woman, about a woman, in a man's space. So we should be talking about gender and doing a feminist analysis lens in a book now, because at a holistic level, it's interesting. But this is how Elizabeth Moon is choosing to write about a female fantasy hero, a warrior and a mercenary at this point in time, because she isn't especially strong as a, you know, as a female hero. It feels like, to Elizabeth Moon, at least writing at this time period, what qualified Parks as a strong hero is that she is literally big. She's very tall. She's suitably strong to be a mercenary. She learns how to fight, and eventually she gets quite good at fighting. And that's kind of all that needs to happen.
It's very interesting, because what we get here, and I'm really glad we're diving into the aspect, from Pax's perspective, she is just trying to be good at her job.
Yeah.
And by being good at her job, she's hoping that, you know, everyone is just going to be good and respect her. And what we see throughout the book is that, well, it's in her own mercenary company, this completely comes to pass. There's no people in her own company who disrespect her or talk down to her based on her gender.
Except for the guy who's like partially responsible for the sexual assault, who's then immediately like mutilated and kicked out of the company.
Yes. Now, cathartism?
Well, we can get into the specifics of that in a bit. Let's keep having a holistic view and then we can zoom in.
So what does this sort of mean? Also, look at fantasy in general. Now, obviously, roll back that statement. Moon did serve. And I am going to go on a limb and say that probably a lot of what's been presented here must be either drawing from her experiences, or it's meant to be option A. Or it's meant to be her sort of saying, no, I kind of want to create this fantasy of what I would want the experience to be, or what I believe it should be.
Now, I'm actually annoyed at myself that I didn't bring this up during the recording of the episode, but it should be worth highlighting, considering how much we're talking now about Elizabeth Moon's depiction of sexual assault within the armed forces as a former servicewoman. We really need to highlight the fact that what this is relating to is the overwhelming prevalence of sexual violence between fellow soldiers. I'm not even talking about between combatants. Between fellow soldiers on the same side, it's outrageous. The statistics that you find coming out of the Pentagon are beyond egregious. You're talking about estimated, in 2012, I think it was an estimated 30,000 estimated assault cases, which under 3,000 were actually reported. US servicewomen are more likely to be raped by their own compatriots than killed in combat. And in 2021, after there is more awareness of these problems within the armed forces, only 43% of such assaults result in a court-martial. And I'm mentioning the US Armed Forces because, you know, Elizabeth Moon served in the United States Marine Corps, but, like, the problem is outrageous in the United Kingdom as well. And, of course, Duncan and I are British citizens, and the rampant culture of misogyny and sexual violence is egregious. And the crazy thing is that, anyway, we needed to bring it up, and I'm disappointed I didn't bring it up during the recording of the episode itself.
The point is that, yes, this is obviously coming from a certain perspective of her having served in the military as a woman in that case, in the early 70s, I guess, and now she's writing about it in the late 80s. But what also should be borne in mind is that the armed forces of pretty much every country, but especially the United States, and especially the United States Marine Corps, has a strong habit of really amping up the idea of prestige and honor at being associated with this particular fighting force. I remember I interviewed a former US Marine, and he told me, and I really wish I could be more specific about this, but it's been such a long time since he described it to me, and I have forgotten. But basically, the United States Marine Corps' formal uniform are blue trousers with a red stripe going down the side. And this red stripe, according to Marine Corps legend, is in honor of a group of Marines who died in a fearsome battle, and that's like supposed to be a streak of blood. And that is not true. It's just a myth. Like, they had the red stripe beforehand, or it's not related to it whatsoever. It's just a myth which they've generated about themselves to give themselves a certain level of bravura, of warrior mystique, as Frank Herbert would put it.
I mean, certainly quite a common aspect. And I do like the idea of, I don't know, trying to up your own legend or create legends that exemplify the ideals that you want to aspire to.
The point is, okay, let's zoom in on the specifics then. My girlfriend's distracting me, she's waving at me. For the most part in this book, the troop which Parks is with always acts in an honourable way. They run into mercenaries who don't act in an honourable way, and they wave their fingers and they tut at them, and they even threaten to go into violence over seeing these guys pillage, as though, you know, armies throughout history, that it would be so unheard of for the good guys to pillage local villages they were marching through, because that's literally what keeps armies going. Yes, there's a certain romanticism of the military and the armed forces in this book that persists, and that's even carried through the way in which the trial over Parks' assault is carried, because justice does prevail. Because this is a one-off incident, which is seen as completely shocking by the higher-ups, and it's so unthinkable that it could happen, that's why they're reticent to even start the trial. But when it does happen, it's so thoroughly done in that the people who took part in it are stripped out of the mercenary company, they're mutilated, and they're banished. And on one hand, this is so resoundingly just that you'd think this is a complete, obvious, simple fantasy of, okay, I'm in with a group of good people, they have believed me, and I don't have to worry about this happening in the future. And indeed, it never happens again in the future. It's never threatened against her again in the future, as far as we've read, at least in this book. And she barely thinks about it. And that's interesting to me.
This is very interesting. So when this event first goes down, by the way, there's actually quite a key point where Pax is almost put off by the level of discipline
that's bestowed upon these people. Yes, that's the really strange part.
It's an interesting decision to make, because it shows Pax, I don't think she's ever regretful of obviously like this coming to pass, but she's just, I think if it's meant to be her like balking at how they handle, you know, how they handle all of these people, it's not meant to be that their career's over, or is it the violence? The violence confused me, because I'm like, Pax, you're a trained killer. You do remember that. You literally get paid to murder other people. These guys are just getting whipped. I'm not saying that's nothing, but still.
Yeah.
And yeah, it doesn't really come up. In fact, there's one scene later where someone else who was semi-implicated in this, but was sort of written off because it's generally suggested that he was drugged, his friend comes over and is like, "Ah, you're Pax. You're the one that got my mate into all that trouble."
And then
I thought, oh, that is a...
Yep. Yes, and the issue, you know what?
No, but I thought that's...
Yes, sorry, I didn't mean to interrupt you, Duncan, but that is a good scene, because that's a great example of an injustice that can be carried out in a male-dominated space, where the victim is seen as an aggressor in that they've gotten in the way of the good old boys. And you're like, oh yeah, this is something that has to hang around Parks's neck. The mere fact that she was victimized is now used against her. What a weighty and poignant thing to point out, Elizabeth.
Could this come up further in the novel? No, that man then just dies in a battle off page, and then it's fully buried.
No, forget that. I mean, literally what happens is, old mate, the guy they're talking about, who was like implicated in the attempted rape, immediately walks over and is like, hey, it's my good old friend Parks. Parks, remember how you and I are cool, and there's no blood between us? Oh, hey, pal, I didn't see you there. Did you get the memo that we're not being mean to Parks? And then he's immediately fine and cool with it.
Yes. And it's this sort of, everyone in this company is so good. And what's really interesting, there is genuinely a small section in this book where character Vic brings this up to Parks. It's like, oh no, we're not all good. Like, it's very explicitly, I've got a quote here again, where this character Vix is saying, I'm not saying Barra, another person in the company, is bad, exactly. But I'm saying you think she's good at heart because you like her and want her to be good at heart. It doesn't work that way. If you don't learn to see people as they are, you'll get hurt someday. Potential foreshadowing. I'm like, oh, that's you bringing in that idea that Pax thinks really well of all these people, so they all appear to be good.
Yeah.
But then nothing in this first book suggests that's not just the case.
Yeah, there's like there's a scene in the book where there's like a looting frenzy, and like everyone, like they storm over a castle and they just go berserk, ripping things up. But it has none of the skill and poignancy of that exact same scene happening in Best Served Cold, where the sense of powerful greed like overwhelms people and drives them mad. Whilst the battle is still going on, they enter looting mode straight away. It's so well delivered there that in comparison here, it's just like, it feels so absent from the book. It feels almost like she wrote the book without the looting scene happening. And then later down the line was like, oh man, I really should include like soldiers looting because that's their favorite thing to do since the dawn of time. And then go back and then add this scene later because it leaves no impact on Parks whatsoever. It doesn't change her opinion on anyone except the militia, who are not her compatriots.
I almost feel like if this had been first person, I'd be more forgiving, because then we could have a better sense of, oh no, this is just Pax's perspective.
Yeah, she has Pax cognitive dissonance.
Sworn to the notion. She can't see the evil in her companions. Because of the third person, I'm like, no, you're just telling me they're like this. They're not that bad. It just doesn't quite land for me. But that opening section, like, while the trial's going on, is really interesting written. And it is a cool idea. I just wish maybe it was followed up on more throughout the novel. The implications of this on Pax. But it does feel a little bit sweet under the rug.
I'd like
until something else interesting happens later on.
Sorry, I was going to move on too, but it sounds like you want to move on somewhere else.
No, where were you going to move on to?
I was going to move on to the last good section of a book, which is right in the middle, and it's the like week long trek, from their capture by the Honeycat's men, and then they have to race to the Duke and tell him that this has happened.
Same. This is exactly where I was going. This is the second most interesting, or potentially maybe the first, part of the novel. It happens midway through, and we actually get this exciting mini-mission where, as Geordie's just described, Pax is separated from the main troop. Like a contingency of them were sent to like a distant border fort. And, bit weird, they got another army came up, they surrendered to them, and then while they were being sort of captives around with that group of people, a second army rocked up, this one run by the Honeycat, and the people in the fort have to drop the portcullis, go into defense mode, and Pax and two compatriots are cut off. They were like foraging for berries outside, and now they have to do this sneaky sprint across country to get word back to the main army so that they can march up and relieve the fortress.
And this section is great. It's way more exciting than any of the other action sequences because I feel like it really plays to her strengths. And, you know, this is part of what I think Moon is bringing to this as someone who has experience of military service, which is that, you know, it can be extremely perilous and exciting just to have to travel a lot big distance across land in an exhausting and dangerous way. One of your compatriots has a wound, which is getting worse. You have to forage for food and steel. You have to think really hard about how close to the enemy should I stay. We want to stay close so we can keep an eye on them and steal their food, but not too close that we'll get caught. A lot of big, smart decisions have to be made. There's a scene where, like, they get spotted by a sentry, and they have to take him down before we can ride his horse away. And then right towards the end, when you think they've come to a safe haven, oh no, it's actually a bandit trap, and then they have to fight for their lives.
There's bits in this section, and I mentioned earlier how, like, I was saying to my girlfriend, oh, if it gets really great in the last 20 pages, I'd almost be annoyed because it'd be Moon letting me know that she could write like this the whole time. This section felt like it should be how the whole story was written to me, and maybe that's because I'm not picking up on the boring aspects of the military life, but there's so much in this mission that works. Firstly, Pax is encouraged, although I don't think she fully takes advantage of the idea of being forced into a role of leadership. Fantastic. One of the wounded people has this other god, and in their sort of I might not make it, we get some really nice conversations. Also, Geordie, this is actually one of the times where Moon just absolutely home run. Something that she does, which she's clearly passionate about, actually aligned perfectly with me. I went, do you know what? I respect you for this. We get accurate, to the T, rations maths.
Yes!
Amazing. When they get 3 loaves of bread and 1/2 a wheel of cheese and 18 berries, they work out exactly how many days they can make on that, and it lines up with the number of days that they need to travel based on information given prior. Like, it is perfect.
It really is great, and I promise you, it's not boring. Duncan may have sounded like they were doing like a calorie counting or something, but no, that is actually a really interesting and like almost tense moment of like, we have this much, do we need to steal more? How many eggs do we have? I'm not going to eat raw eggs. Well, Pax, you're going to have to bloody eat raw eggs because this is all we have.
We also get in this section, genuinely the most like character moment of the entire book, where not Pax, one of her compatriots, goes up to like speak to a farmer. They're like, right, do we just steal from them? No, just go up and like try and chat to them first and see what happens. So this guy rocks up to this farmer's looking wife and they have this ridiculous exchange of, oh dear mother, I'm a wandering traveller and I need some supplies. And she goes, well, why don't you just come inside my house and I'll give you some. He's like, no, I will not go in there. You will murder me. How about you just bring them out to me? And I'm like, what is this dialogue? We've not had this much dialogue of people just sort of expressing personality and negotiating a situation. What is this?
What I like about that scene too is that it takes what almost works about a lot of different action scenes in this book, which is that Pax never walks away unscathed, and it just skirts it to a more reasonable amount. Like, Pax can't go to a doctor in this. So when she gets into this fight, she gets like scratched up, and you get the sense that, yeah, Pax is not this unstoppable killing machine. She's a proficient fighter, but she's outnumbered, and someone like threw a knife at her and she just barely escaped of her life. It's tense, she's a professional, but she's not John Wick. She sustains damage, and she just manages to win through, and that makes it exciting. I like the fact that Pax never walks away unscathed from a fight.
I'm happy for her not to walk away unscathed. I just don't like it when she falls completely unconscious. Hard cuts.
We've gone over that. We're on the same page there. Let's not get distracted. I really like this week-long section. You feel the fatigue. You were talking earlier about how you wanted Parks to have to be like pulling her boots off the end of the day and groaning. This is the section where you feel that. There's also a bit later where there's like Parks is literally just outpacing her comrades because they're more tired than her and she has big long legs. And like, Parks, you have to slow down so that we can keep up. It's just these little things that really make it vivid and real and intense.
And these are two very interesting characters. We have, I believe it's Senna, who is set up as the one that introduces this god, who I believe Parks is going to go on to be a paladin for. And we have this...
He's a saint, but at this point in the book, she does think he's a god, yes.
And, oh my goodness, Jordy, I'm forgetting the other chap's name. I have too many good names written down. Which one was he?
Is it Kalina?
Kalina. Doesn't quite sound right, but we can go. This is the friend who, earlier on, expresses a romantic interest. And Max is like, I'm just not interested in that. And then they're like this super wonderful, respectful, okay. Like, that's not our relationship.
Yes, he's a nice boy. Yeah, I actually, you know, thank you for bringing it up. Pax Sinarin is either a very early and therefore quite bold example of asexuality in a fantasy heroine, in which case, good job, Elizabeth Moon, you're way ahead of your time. Or, and I think this is probably a teeny bit more likely, she didn't feel that she could have the strong female protagonist if she also had lovers. If she had boyfriends, and I assume in the 80s, certainly not girlfriends, then that would be seen as delegitimizing from her position of badass fantasy heroine. She's not allowed to both be, you know, somebody's girlfriend, somebody's wife, or what have you, and be a renegade knight on the prowl fighting against evil. And that's disappointing. I mean, there might be more going on there. Maybe it's because she has a love interest coming up and Moon wants to keep her chaste for that. I don't know. All in all, it goes to show how far we've come in the world of fantasy spaces with female heroines. And we genuinely do have to thank Sarah J. Maas for this, is that we can have female characters who have relationships, they have romantic relationships, sexual relationships, sometimes casual sexual relationships, and it doesn't detract from their status of being a fantasy hero.
Oh gosh, there is a shadow of a character called Red Sonja behind you, mate, that we might have to look at someday soon. I personally, when I read this, took the more positive spin. I actually read this as a early example of Ace, and there's one particular scene after that potential love interest tragically dies where everyone's sort of talking about like, oh, we thought you were with them. Yeah, we all just assumed you were being intimate together. And I can't remember the exact words, and I feel like I really should to kind of land this argument. Although it's really just why my brain went that way. But Pax is thinking back about like, oh, well, why didn't I? And I just feel like there's something in the word choice at that moment, or perhaps just kind of being like, well, it just doesn't interest me. It just wasn't something I wanted to have in that relationship. I was fulfilled with them. And that I kind of went, I'm leaning towards that Ace. How true it is to the writer's intent, I don't know.
Yes, exactly. That was my reading of the same scene as well. But it also was like, I probably don't think this is what the author intended, but also death the author, I can have my own reading until that's like contradicted by the narrative. And also at this point, it certainly hasn't. So we talked about the mission, which I thought was really good. I do want to very quickly focus on what I think is probably the worst part of the novel, by some degrees. So this is way towards the end. They've caught up to Silvanari. They're fighting against his armies. And at this point, aside from the fact that Silvanari sent his army and, like, killed a bunch of Pax's friends, that should be really dramatic stuff. You know, that should be, like, she should be like, I am dead set on vengeance. I'm all in because I want to get my own back.
Sinari being the honey cat, by the way.
Parks could not give less of a shit about revenge. It never gets brought up. Only the Duke seems to want revenge. the point is that Parks doesn't have any personal stake in bringing down the bad guy. It's just her job. It's just her duty. Which might well jive with, like, Moon being like, yeah, soldiers just sort of do what they're told. That's what they do. Fair enough, but it's not very dramatic. If I had written this book, I would have had that the Honey Cat rode up against that, like, castle himself, and he took off his helmet, and, like, he was the one who made the threatening thing, and he gave the order to kill prisoners and stuff. Make it really focused in. Make it personal. Make it so that Parks has seen this guy in action. You know, have Darth Vader walk out, pick a guy up by his throat, and slam him into a wall. Show me him. Show him being the bad guy so I can really get invested in bringing him down. The closest we come to that is 85% away through the book. Moon goes, shit, this guy has not shown up yet. They're actively trying to hunt him down and kill him, and he has not shown up, and we've been given no real reason to actually hate him specifically. So here's what we're going to do. The captain shows up and says, alright guys, we have a stealth mission we got to do. The Halvarix, that's his name, the Halvarix is the other mercenary company we're working with. His eldest son has been kidnapped. I'm putting it together, a team of volunteers to sneak into the enemy camp. And I think to myself, okay, we're close to the end of the book. This is the last mission. This is going to be the point where she's going to go on a mission behind enemy lines. It's going to go wrong. And then Parks is going to have to take him down herself and prove herself as the big hero. They sneak across the river. They've been given all this preparation. They know what the enemy password is. They get to the other side. And two guys walk up and like, hey, we already rescued him for you. Here you go.
Oh, it's flipping unbelievable, isn't it?
This, it's, by the way, so abrupt. Yeah.
It's like the third most interesting thing I thought was going to happen. Yeah, you know, we've got the trial early on. You've got that middle mission. I'm like, ah, oh, this is the exciting bit at the end of the book. And I'm like, not only does this, like, take the wind out of your sails, we then get this really odd chapter where the perspective shifts from Pack to the person they're meant to be rescuing. And oh my god, Jordy, why did I need this, like, torture chapter? Just to make the villain villainous?
Yes, very strange. It's a very strange bit where for one chapter, we enter into the head of a guy that we have met. Like, he has shown up in a book before, but he's not been that important. And we never actually see the Honey Cat, but it's the only scene he gets to appear in which he menaces this guy. He, like, he tries to bribe him, he interrogates him, he has him, like, beaten up and tortured, and then has him gelded. Like, his balls are cut off. We don't see this happen, to be clear. Like, we aren't going, like, full, I don't know, Prince of Thorns. I don't know what happens in that book.
Oh, some shit Mark Lawrence. Way worse than that, sicko. Mate, happens in that book.
There we go. And then he gets, like, rescued by strangers who we never actually properly meet. He gets brought back, and he has to have a conversation with his dad, who's like, it doesn't matter to me that you've had your balls chopped off, son. You've already had kids. You've done your job.
It felt so weird and out of place. Like, it was a tenderly, I'm not gonna lie, though. I was genuinely found it a little bit heartfelt. Why?
Yes, you know what? I do. That's true. It is just that the whiplash you get from the villain has not appeared yet to the villain confronts a guy we've never met before and has his balls cut off, and then this poor guy has to ride a horse to get rescued, which is terribly sad, only to then be comforted by the Duke and Halvari and never actually talk to Parks. Like, it isn't Parks who's there to help comfort him. It isn't Parks who rescues him. It isn't Parks who stands up for him and says, like, well, listen, why do you care? He's already had kids. Stop bringing him down. She doesn't have anything to do with it. And in fact, immediately after this scene, one chapter later, a night ambush is sprung against their group. And it just so happens that the main bad guy is here. He just so happens to be near to Parks. And she wrestles him to the ground. And she gets woken up from, like, a magic sleeping spell by her amulet. She's chosen by Gerd. She's a paladin. Blah, blah, blah. and she brings him down. And the final only contribution Park's made, as we said before, is that she's the one to make a decision that he shouldn't be tortured to death. And the one weird thing here, I don't want to get hopped on this. I said I'd be really quick. The Duke is like, I'm going to get my revenge. I'm going to really kill this guy. The person who's really easy to talk down is Halvarik. He's like, yeah, sure. I'm just chill, man. You say, Park's the person I've never actually like had a proper conversation with, that we should be merciful to him. I'm game. Whatever. I don't care. Your son's balls got chopped off. You should be the one who's hard to convince.
It's hard to cut back in after all that, Geordie. But you're right, it's a really odd ending. It feels like Pax doesn't have that much agency. And to the very last second, where one person turns around and goes, what should we do with him? Or, I can't decide. Ah, Pax's wrestled him to the ground. Let that, not even a sergeant, make the decision. And you're like, can I make a little comparison here? It's like you're playing D&D.
I'm going to make a comparison too. Okay.
So, no, I'm going to do a D&D comparison. It's genuinely like you've gone to the end and you've got the main villain, and then all of a sudden your DM's like, oh my god, no, they're only NPCs who logically should make this decision. I need to get one playable character involved.
That happens a lot as a DM. I have to really work over myself to be like, so there's a very important council meeting happening. What do you weird homeless people think? It reminded me of, Duncan, is the Telltale games. Like, in the Telltale Walking Dead, you start off playing Lee, who's an adult man, and who has to make a lot of the very important decisions. It's one of those video games that cares about the decisions you make. And then in the sequel, you play Clementine, who is a 13-year-old girl. And all of the adults come to an impasse when deciding what should be done, and then they have to turn to Clementine and they say, what do you think, Clementine? We'll definitely listen to you, the 13-year-old. You can make the decision about what happens.
It's just got a bit of dissonance, and it didn't feel built up to. Again, this could have worked. Pax has had lots of interactions with the Duke throughout this story. Maybe she says something early on that he takes on board or influences his opinion. Maybe, you know, this could be something that's growing and growing, and they've got a relationship building. I do not feel like these two truly have a relationship other than person in army and head of army. And like the Duke's coming around to like respect her. This feels so left field. It's like the Duke basically says, I can't be arsed today. Someone else just finished the job.
Really what it should come down to is Park should be the one. It should be much more intense. It should be much more in a moment. There shouldn't be time for a committee meeting. Parks should have brought him down, which she did, and then have her sword at his throat, and then be about to, like, kill him. Look to her Duke to be like, should I take him captive? And the answer should be, like, Parks is the one with the sword at his throat. She should be the one to make the decision about should he die quickly or in a long, drawn-out manner, because she should be the one to do it. Like, that makes sense. Center your main character at the accumulation of the story. Like, you're talking about some Attack of the Clone shit, where, like, you have Anakin and Obi-Wan show up, fight the bad guy, get completely wiped out, accomplish absolutely nothing, and then need Yoda to show up to save their bacon.
Again, it might make more sense as you've read the scene again. I don't know why I say the word again. Maybe it makes more sense in the sequels, but for this book, it just feels almost kind of just anticlimactic and unearned. And also, other thing that bothered me in this scene, Hanks just doesn't have much of a internal dilemma.
Opinion.
Yeah, nah. We don't know.
She doesn't think about the people she's lost or reasons why she ought to be angry. She doesn't choose to rise above her base nature. She seems almost confused about why everyone else is so upset.
It kind of, I don't know, threw me through a bit of a loop. Again, it's just one of those things that made me feel very distant from Pax and made me realise that we've had this entire 44-page novel. I've come to the end and I still just don't feel like I know this character. I know they'll do the right thing because, sod it, they're already a paladin and will just robotically do the good deed. But that just feels like it. That's a little heartbreaking.
Duncan, we've talked about maybe it makes more sense in the novels. do we have anything else to say about the book before we talk about whether we consider reading the next book in this series? That's probably not going to happen, but we should also discuss it.
I have nothing more to add, Audie. Well, actually, quick question. Is this fantasy? Because I'm not going to lie, I had some early points where I was like, is this going to be fantasy?
It's, of course, it's fantasy. There's people summoning storm clouds.
It is, but it's definitely a very light touch. And I'll be honest, for most of the training section, like the first third, I was like, other than it being set in a different place, nothing's happening. And that's cool. It can be a slow burn. Yeah. It can be low.
Until someone says, oh, it's a magic potion. And he turns to his friend and be like, you buy these things all the time for you and your girlfriend. And he's like, yeah, we buy love potions just to spice things up. And that's when I was like, oh yeah, this is a fantasy novel. There are witches and magical potions.
So yes, very low fantasy, but really, I don't think there's much more to be said on that. I definitely get the sense that maybe the fantasy is going to build into it more of the world. More of the books go forward. But Geordie, shall we be reading them?
Well, technically speaking, it's not my decision to make. You get to decide whether we read the next one. But in my own personal time, no, I'm not going to be reading this.
Oh, I can promise you, I will never be picking up a Deezer Pexarian novel again. I don't think. If someone came to me and told me that the next series written by Moon was completely different, like, it's a little bit of a John Gwynne scenario here. I can see the seeds of good writing, and there are really good bits in this book, but I felt there was just a lot of flag in between and not enough engagement with the actual characters on display, and not enough intricate world building to offset that either way. But there are moments of high competency which make me go, okay, we could work. There's something here. There is talent. Moon clearly is talented. Maybe someone came to me and went, no, don't worry. But in like, by book 9 of a different series, you know, the 9th book they publish, that's a corker. I would buy it. Same with John Gwynne. I did not like Malice, but I could see where things could go. And when people tell me, oh, you should try out his later series, I'm like, yeah, maybe one day I will actually.
Maybe. We have a lot to he has to do a lot to make us forgive him, though. You know what I just realized? I realized two things, actually. You know what I just realized? The bit we really liked in the middle of the book, where it's about being on the run, and they've got a mission, and they're getting tired, and it's very... constantly there's danger following behind them. We just described Green Rider.
I know. As time goes on, I look back on Green Rider more and more positively. It was a very early
Duncan,
one.
Duncan, I really wish those books stayed as good, but I'm like most of the way through the third book in that series, and it never comes close to that first book.
Which is a real shame. I highly recommend, if you're listening to this, go back, check out our episode on Green Rider, sorry for the bad audio, and then go and read Green Rider. It is an amazing fantasy novel.
To be honest, you shouldn't listen to the episode, because in the episode right at the start, we're going to say, hey, stop listening to this episode, go read this book, and then come back. Read the book! It's brisk, it's fun, it's a very early example of having a very well-written, strong female character as the lead in a fantasy story. Who's allowed to have romantic interests, and that's not seen as a limiting factor against her, but whatever. Moving on. The second thing I realized at a certain point during this episode is, you know what would be a really great book? Take The Sheep Farmer's Daughter, and take The Poppy War.
Yes.
Put them in a Large Hadron Collider and slam them into each other at the speed of light, and you would come out with an amazing book. If you could cancel out all the weaknesses with the strengths of the other, somewhere in there's a fantastic book. A book about a war with clear stakes, with a strong main character who has conflict with others who are distinct and memorable. That, and also just like dilute down the absolute horror of the Siege of Nanjing in... with the pleasantness of this book, and you have a real corker, a real beauty.
Likewise, what will also fall out the Hydron Collider on the other end is this abomination of a novel. But oh my let's not God. Think about that one.
An extremely boring and absolutely abysmally dark story. Oh yeah, it's the Prince of Thorns again. I can't take Potchless like that. I haven't read more than two chapters of it.
I've read the entire really thing. Mean. I'm just going to say now, I really like it, but it's hard to recommend. So, Jordy, we come to the end, and it's quite nice. I say quite nice. It's actually refreshing for me to have you bring a book to the table that I didn't go quite mad for. I feel like we recently, particularly with like Delaguts and Straight Razor's Cure, had a few of my books that you really took the knife to. So I feel it's refreshing for one of your recommendations to not quite land.
That's right. I'm only human after all. I will tell you this, Duncan. Recently, I was going back through, and I think that on the whole, this year, the quality of books has been pretty high.
We did Watership Down this year. That alone pulls the point average up significantly. I still think about that one. That stuck in my head.
Now, the question is, we had a little bit of a wobble here. Where are we going to go? Are we going to get back on course? Or is it time to really delve into some crap? Is Duncan going to try and find the other end of a Large Hadron Collider? Which I'm just realizing is a weird thing because it is a circle.
it's a donut. So technically, you know, you could stand on either side of it, in and out.
I don't want to disagree with you, Duncan, on principles of mathematics, but I think donuts and circles both do not have ends.
Yeah, but they have an inside perimeter and outside the perimeter is what I'm getting at.
Okay. It just teleports into, like, the lounge which these scientists sit in wearing their Miss Marvel shirts. Duncan, what are we doing next time?
That's an amazing question. And I have gone through the absolute remit trying to pick our next book, Geordie. In fact, I've had no less than four books on the docket that I've been struggling to pick between. And some I've gone, this could be really good, but I'm not sure, maybe I feel up to one of that length right now. Others I've gone, oh, I'd love to give this a go, but damn it, I can't find my copy anywhere. So I think what we need to explore some of the things we've already talked about. We need to explore how you take a book which maybe isn't high octane, which maybe has some more of a mundane, slow pace, but how that can be really interesting and how good character work can draw you into a novel no matter what.
If you're expecting me to guess what it is, Duncan, I'm lost. I have no idea. Tell me, what is it for next time?
We are going to read truly a classic of the 1950s/40s. I'm not actually 100% sure at this moment. Geordie, I think we need to read some Moomins.
The Moomins?
Yes, mate.
Duncan, I could have been here and guessed 100 times. I would not have come up with the Moomins.
The famed characters created by Swedish author.
I thought it was Finnish.
You're right. The beloved characters created by Finnish
author. I know so little about Finland, Duncan. I know that that's what they had, an epic that inspired Elric. I know a surprising amount about the Winter War.
Sorry.
And I know the Moomins.
Can I just clarify? Just because I'm reading at the moment from Wikipedia, a Swedish-speaking Finnish author is the sentence at the top.
Oh, come on!
So that's where I'm confused.
There are parts of Finland where they speak Swedish, it's true.
Tove Jansson. And obviously the Moomins, there are many different Moomin books, but I'm going to pick one, not the very first one. Instead, we're going to go for Finn Family Moomin Troll.
Okay, I literally don't know what format this is. I assume I'm not going to get an audiobook. Is this a picture book, Duncan? Like, what are we dealing with here?
That's a very good question. It does have... It's not a picture book. although Moomins are quite famously related to the illustrations done by the author, and there are very successful Moomin comics. So you definitely would benefit, I think, from having a physical copy to experience those images. Similar to, I think the best comparison I can make would be something like The Hobbit. There are images as you go through done by the author, but it is still predominantly a prose story. The images don't tell the story.
Okay, well, colour me intrigued. I have very little relationship to the Moomins, aside from a short period of maybe 2023, where Moomins became very popular on Twitter for a while.
The world, eh? I honestly had very little, to be honest. When I was a kid, as a late teen, I genuinely was concerned that there was some weird sort of special dream I'd had, because I went for a period where I was like, what were those white hippos? I remember watching a show of white hippos at some point. And actually, it was only when I met my partner, who is a Moomin fan and has all the books and several comic collections.
The truth comes out.
Ah, these are the Moomins. And there is a delightful book series with a fascinating story behind them. I think Tove Jansson has so much of what she went through in life is sort of put into those books. And that's almost an equally interesting story in and of itself. But first, let's get acquainted with the Moomin family ourselves. We'll meet Moomin Papa, and Moomin Mama, and Moomin Troll, Snork Maiden, and all the rest next time. Well, everyone, I hope you're not a massive fan of The Sheep Farmer's Daughter and deeply upset by our critique.
And we hope that you're a massive fan of the Moomins.
I hope so. And if you are either of those things or neither of them, please let us know your thoughts and opinions. The best place, as always, is on our Instagram, isitfantasypodcast, our Google Gmail, isitfantasypodcast@gmail.com, and our Blue Sky at Just Fantasy. Love to hear from you, particularly whenever you just get a small comment on Instagram going, really like this episode, or your critique was so insightful, Duncan, well done. I share it with Geordie, it makes my day, it makes our week. And we also just like to hear your thoughts on what we should cover going forward. I always like to remind people, like, we've had entire episodes inspired by people writing and asking us questions. It really does kind of get that engagement and make us want to make more content for you. So please do reach out.
And until then, I've been your host, Geordie Bailey.
And I've been your other host, Duncan Nicol. Till next time.
So long.
Bye.
Yeah, there's a reason why the Americans call one of their departments of fighting people the chair force.
They don't go into battle wielding chairs?
That's not, I'm afraid not. It isn't just Stone Cold Steve Austin running around with steel chairs, messing up the Taliban, no.